flies used to catch sea trout. He had recently begun to dabble in classic salmon flies and had come to Zwolle to see the masters in action. But he didn't share the community's obsession with rare birds. Irish wandered through the tent until he arrived at Bocholt's booth. Next to the bespectacled Dutchman's vice was a Victorian cabinet containing 20 slender trays, originally designed to store antique microscope slides. Bocholt pulled them out one by one, revealing hundreds of flies with many thousands of dollars worth of rare feathers tied into them. When Irish and Bocholt started talking about hard-to-get feathers, the Dutchman couldn't resist showing off one of his latest purchases, a flawless, full, blue chatterer skin. To Irish, it didn't look like the birds that occasionally popped up on eBay after being pried out of a Victorian hat with outstretched wings and legs. Its eye sockets were stuffed with ancient-looking cotton, and the wings and feet were tied closely to the body. "Where'd you get this?" he asked casually. Nearly a year earlier, he had seen reports about the Tring heist, so when he saw the Dutchman's museum-grade skin, something fired in his mind, and his suspicions flared. "Some kid in England named Edwin Rist?" When he got home, Irish logged on to classicflytying.com and began clicking through the items being sold on the trading floor. The night before the Dutch fly fair, a listing had gone up. "Flame Bowerbird, male, full skin for sale." The post had already amassed 1,118 views. He discovered several other links on the forum to eBay listings of birds of paradise, in which forum members mentioned that the skins were located in England. Irish found that most of the auctions were posted by the same seller. He rang the Hertfordshire Constabulary and told them to look into the eBay username FlutePlayer1988. The message made its way to Adele, who petitioned eBay for the legal name and address of the person holding the account FlutePlayer1988. When the name Edwin Rist came back, she ran him through their system and discovered that he was a student at the Royal Academy of Music. When she shared this information with Mark Adams and Robert Press Jones at the Tring, they confirmed that someone by that name had visited the museum 6 months prior to the theft. Adele wasn't easily excitable, but this was the best lead she'd had since the case was assigned to her. She quickly dialed the school administrators to locate Edwin, but discovered that she had just missed him. He had boarded a plane back to the States for summer break only 2 weeks earlier, and had moved out of the apartment eBay had on record. 13 months had passed since the burglary, and now they were 14 days too late? Her department didn't have much in the way of a travel budget. She had a hard enough time getting approval for a train ticket to London, so a flight to New York to interrogate Edwin was off the table. But she was concerned about the fate of the skins. The more time passed, the more likely they were to be separated from their tags, rendering them worthless to the Tring. Had he taken them with him to the United States? If he had left them in England, where were they? The United States was unlikely to grant any favors by extraditing Edwin back to England. She would have to wait until he returned on his own and hope that he hadn't traveled with the skins. When the Royal Academy of Music's fall term commenced on September 13th, the start of Edwin's fourth and final year of study, Adele was still trying to determine his exact whereabouts. She couldn't get a search warrant authorized without a valid address, and she was still waiting on the school to notify her once Edwin registered his new off-campus address. Meanwhile, Edwin was back and moving product. In an email to his network of customers, he announced his September 2010 offerings, including a blue chatterer with full plumage for $1,000, excluding shipping. A few weeks later, he was sending messages to Jens Pilgaard, hoping to sell the Dane some birds of paradise. Perhaps in anticipation of a new wave of sales, he logged into eBay and updated his account with his new address. Shortly thereafter, eBay responded to Adele's request for an updated address for her suspect. A flat in Willesden Green, an 18-minute ride on the underground line from the Royal Academy. The last online listing of Edwin's feathers on classicflytying.com went up on November 11th, 2010. A mixed pack for sale was posted, along with an image showing 9 pairs of feathers neatly arranged on a dark canvas backdrop. Beneath each pair, the subspecies and available quantities were typed in a white bold font. That night, Edwin and his girlfriend went to bed on the earlier side. He had a rehearsal the following morning and wanted to be at his best. His dream of playing for the Berlin Philharmonic wasn't far from reach. He would soon graduate with a degree from one of the world's best conservatories, positioning him for auditions with the finest orchestras. He already had an invitation to audition with the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He had just turned 22. Early in the morning of November 12, 2010, Adele and 2 of her colleagues drove down from the Hemel Hempstead police station to London, their GPS set for the address of Flute Player 1988. If she had had only his name, she would have been skeptical that Edwin, an American music student without any prior record, was her man. But she had his eBay records, which included listings of exotic birds and purchases of mothballs, Ziploc bags, and a diamond blade glass cutter. She knew he'd visited the Tring. She was pretty certain. A little bit before 8 in the morning, Edwin's doorbell rang. He was awake, trying not to disturb his sleeping girlfriend as he got ready for his rehearsal. At first, he ignored it. He wasn't expecting any packages and was a bit pressed for time. But now someone was banging on the door. "Who is it?" he asked through the door. "It's the police," Adele said. "Open the door." 507 days after he broke into the museum, Edwin opened the door, glanced at Adele, and asked, "Is something wrong?" Chapter 13. Behind Bars. When Adele told him they were there to investigate the Tring robbery and had a warrant to search his apartment, Edwin confessed immediately. He knew they would find the birds. There was no point in trying to hide what he'd done. He led them to his room where his girlfriend was just waking up, confused by the commotion. He gestured at the large cardboard boxes containing what remained of the skins. "I was having some psychological problems," he said. "I was depressed. I regretted it. I was going to put the stuff back the next day, and I'm sorry." He pointed out a flat-screen TV in the corner, telling them he had stolen it from the Royal Academy's International Student House, though no one had asked. Adele's colleagues snapped pictures of all the birds as he had stored them in his apartment, which was now a crime scene. They bagged up all the skins, patches of birds, and packs of feathers, including some that hadn't come from the museum, such as the Malayan peacock pheasant he'd received from Jens Pilgaard. They unplugged his laptop and seized his camera and passport. In that moment, Edwin finally succumbed to the shock of what was happening, suddenly feeling hollowed out. Despite all his planning, he had never imagined this moment. Adele placed him under arrest and led him down to the squad car below. With a guilty suspect in the back seat and a trunk full of dead birds, Adele drove to the police station halfway between London and Tring in Watford, which was equipped with 16 custody suites, or jail cells. They took a mugshot and a DNA swab, which would be run against the drop of blood found at the crime scene, and deposited Edwin in a cell by himself to wait. As the bars locked shut, he became extremely agitated. He had no idea how long he'd be there. Nobody even knew where he was. Apart from the first few days after the heist, during which he'd been hounded by anxiety that he'd be found out, he had been certain he wouldn't get caught. But now that he was behind bars, all he saw was uncertainty. Would he go to prison? What would happen to his family? What would happen to his audition with the Boston Symphony? His future as a musician? Adele called up the Tring to tell the curators the good news. Knowing that the skins would require special handling, she summoned them to the station. It was a high moment in her career. She had come to know the museum's staff well, particularly Dr. Press Jones, who had introduced her to the world of Alfred Russel Wallace and the scientific importance of the bird skins. Her newfound appreciation of the specimen's value, which went beyond the monetary, had motivated her to solve the case. And she had done it. The thief was behind bars. All that remained for her to do was the interrogation, and then the Crown Prosecution Service would take over. Since Edwin had admitted his guilt, his case wouldn't go to trial. It would proceed straight to sentencing. Mark Adams arrived in Watford and began the work of identifying each skin. Of the 299 skins that Edwin had taken, 174 intact specimens had been recovered in his apartment. Unfortunately, only 102 skins still retained their labels. A massive blow had been dealt. Only a third of the birds were recovered in a scientifically uncompromised condition. For some of the individual species, the numbers were even more dispiriting. Of the 17 missing flame bowerbirds, 9 had been recovered, but all of them were missing their tags. Of the 47 Indian crow skins, 9 were recovered, but only 4 with tags. 3 of Wallace's birds of paradise were recovered, all without tags. The only detached labels discovered in Edwin's apartment were 2 written in Wallace's handwriting. Of the king birds of paradise, only 3 out of 37 skins were recovered with labels. And those were only the full skins. There was also a heap of Ziploc bags filled with individual feathers or hacked-off segments of breasts, capes, crests, and necks. Identifying the species and subspecies would be challenging, and more devastatingly, it was ultimately pointless. The bird fragments were scientifically useless. After several hours, Adele had Edwin brought into the interrogation room. She asked if he wanted an attorney. Thinking that if he cooperated, it might all blow over, Edwin waived his right to counsel and confessed. He rattled off the names of those who had bought skins: Jens Pilgaard, Andy Bocholt, Dave Karn, Mortimer, and others, and how much they had paid for them. He didn't feel particularly bad naming names. It was their mistake to have trusted him. By that point, Adele's colleagues had already combed through the emails, Skype chat records, and other files on his laptop. They wanted to know who else might have been involved in the burglary. Had someone put him up to this? She asked Edwin. She went through the various fly tires with whom he had exchanged emails prior to the break-in, but he insisted again and again that he had acted alone. In the middle of the interrogation, a fly tumbled out of a ceiling duct onto Adele's notebook. "Oh my God, is that a fly?" she shouted, flicking it from her page. It catapulted across the table and landed next to Edwin, who swiftly trapped it beneath a glass of water. After about an hour, Adele had what she needed. She gave him a slip of paper informing him of the terms of his arrest and the date of his court hearing and released him from custody. Edwin didn't even know where he was. He was equal parts indignant about and confused by his treatment at the hands of the police. An excruciating day in that cell, and all he had was a slip of paper about a court appointment. As he wandered around Watford, trying to get his bearings, he wondered why they hadn't strapped one of those anklets on to track his movements, and an idea flashed through his mind. I could just leave. Chapter 14. Rot in Hell. As he made his way back to his apartment in Willesden Green, Edwin knew he couldn't just flee. He wouldn't make it past security at Heathrow. Detective Sergeant Hopkin had confiscated his passport. He braced himself for the phone call he knew he had to make. His mother answered. Confessing to her was worse than his time in the cell, as he began to sense how the crime would affect his family. When Anton, who was headed off to Juilliard that fall, learned that it was his own brother who had stolen the Tring's birds, he burst into tears. Edwin could hear him crying in the background. There was no one else to blame. Telling everyone he was sorry wouldn't change a thing. After the initial shock, the conversation pivoted toward the more practical question of how to keep Edwin out of prison. They would need to find a lawyer and figure out how to cover legal fees. His father also wanted to locate, buy, and return as many of the stolen skins as he could, with the hope that this might reflect favorably on his son's character. His mother would fly to London in time for his first court appearance 2 weeks later. Following such a monumental event, one expects the world to stop, or to at least reconfigure itself in response to the news. But in those first few days, with the exception of Edwin's family, nobody around him knew what had happened. The morning after his arrest, he reported to rehearsal and played an orchestral piece along with his classmates. But as he practiced, his mind was consumed by the prospect of being deported, which would mean he couldn't graduate. Graduation was only 6 months away. If he left England without a degree, all his hard work would be for nothing. The coveted spots in the most prestigious orchestras would slip from his reach. There were, of course, more immediate fears. After all, it wasn't some petty theft to which he'd pleaded guilty. The birds were worth about $1 million, and he'd broken all sorts of international conventions protecting endangered species by trafficking skins and feathers throughout the world. To survive this, he would need an incredible defense attorney. At his first court appearance on November 26, 2010, at the Hemel Hempstead Magistrates Courthouse, Edwin shuffled into a large glass box for defendants in the middle of the courtroom and pleaded guilty to burglary and money laundering, while his mother and a few friends looked on from the gallery. All criminal cases in the UK begin at the level of the magistrates' court, which typically deals with minor offenses like speeding or drunk and disorderly conduct. But Edwin's prosecutors, armed with a guilty plea and the pile of evidence that Adele had unearthed in his apartment, felt that the sentencing powers of a magistrate judge were insufficient to address the severity of the crime. In the hopes of obtaining leniency, Edwin's lawyer, Andy Harmon, characterized his client's actions as a youthful flight of fancy, a mistake made in the spur of the moment, and Edwin himself as an earnest naïf who, propelled by an obsession with fly-tying and fascination with James Bond, had begun to have extremely childish fantasies about breaking into the museum. He said his client had taken only a couple of weeks to plan the theft, pointed out that he used the train as his getaway vehicle, and noted that he hadn't used exotic tools to break in. He didn't even take a torch, a flashlight, and has been described going around trying to get light off his phone, he added incorrectly. It was a very amateur burglary. The judge was unmoved and accepted the prosecution's petition to transfer the case to the Crown Court, comparable to a superior court in the United States. The British press covered the now sensational news story much more widely than it had the train's original call for help recovering the skins. Flute player admits theft of 299 rare bird skins, the BBC announced. Exotic bird pelts worth millions stolen from Natural History Museum by musician acting out James Bond fantasy, ran the Daily Mail's account. For all the 007 references, though, the British press neglected to mention that Ian Fleming had found his spy's name after stumbling across a copy of Birds of the West Indies, written by the American ornithologist James Bond. It was only a matter of hours before the news hit the forums. On flytyingforum.com, someone posted an article about the arrest under the headline, "Rare Feather Thief Busted, and He's One of Us." Shocking. On flyfishing.co.uk, a user wrote, "I hope Wrist, if found guilty, is jailed and then deported. His feathers and fly collection should be confiscated for incineration." Another replied, suggesting that Edwin might be innocent. Although it would be nice to think that the police only ever arrest the guilty, that is far from the case. The allegations against this man have yet to be proved, and to convict him on this forum is to usurp the function of the courts. There was, however, one poster on flyfishing.co.uk who knew Edwin well. Terry, who had hosted Edwin at his fly-tying guild in Bristol a couple of years earlier, wrote that he was devastated to hear how Edwin had train-crashed his whole life not only as an extremely talented and world-class fly-tier, but as a highly gifted musician. In the heart of the feather underground at classicflytying.com, a user posted a link to one of the articles about the arrest. Before it was deleted by Bud Guidry, the site's administrator, the thread had generated 85 comments and 4,596 views, one of the largest in the site's history. The same tires who were overjoyed by the flood of rare materials Edwin had introduced were now outraged to learn how the college student had obtained them. Anton soon appeared in the comments, defending his brother from what he described as irresponsible accusations. But the more Anton insisted the articles weren't conveying the whole story, the more attacks came. Finally, he asked Guidry to remove the thread. On November 29th, 2010, 3 days after Edwin's initial court appearance, Guidry made an announcement. For reasons I won't disclose, all posts concerning this topic of stolen birds have been deleted. I would appreciate a compliance by all members at this time to restrain from making any other post on this subject. Thanks, the administrative team. John McClane, the retired Detroit detective who had sold Edwin his first feathers, appended an update to his website, where he had once written, "You may not have heard of the Wrist brothers before, but you certainly will in the future. There is no way to condone Edwin's apparent actions, and no real way for me to really understand them," wrote McClane. "The salmon fly tires in general do not deserve a black eye over this now. They, as a group, had absolutely nothing to do with it. There may be an individual or two that knowingly helped after the fact, and I sincerely hope that will be handled by the proper authorities. 99.99% of the fly tires that covet these feathers are as shocked by this as I am." McClane surely recognized that he was one of the more public figures in the community, and that any journalist Googling Edwin Wrist would find his site. He, like Bud Guidry, wanted to do whatever he could to ensure the Tring heist was not a stain on the collective reputation of salmon fly tires, and that the responsibility was borne by Edwin alone. Guidry, perhaps anticipating increased scrutiny from the authorities, also deleted many of the illegal sales posted on the forum's trading floor, which meant they would no longer appear in a Google search. Unless someone had the specific URL for each post, they were irretrievable. Still an active member of the forum, Edwin saw vicious comments made by people he had known for nearly a decade. Some of his former friends, mentors, and customers were saying he should rot in hell for what he'd done. Edwin's sentencing began on January 14, 2011, at the St. Albans Crown Courthouse, an hour north of London. The Honorable Judge Stephen Gullick asked Edwin to identify himself, before asking one of his lawyers, Peter Dawson, a series of rapid-fire questions. Referring to documents submitted by the defense, the judge asked, "Are you going to invite the sentencing court to go down some form of mental health route?" "I'd certainly invite the court to consider a sentence which would not involve immediate custody," Dawson replied. "That's not my question," Judge Gullick snapped. "I know it's not your question." "It's a deliberately phrased question," the judge stated. "Are you seeking some form of disposal which involves, albeit in the community maybe, some form of mental health requirement?" "Yes," Dawson answered. If Edwin's sentencing was to revolve around a mental health defense, the court would need a professional assessment. Dawson said he had someone in mind, but it might take several weeks to schedule an analysis. Their exchange concluded, the judge turned to Edwin. "Edwin Wrist, just stand a moment. You must come back on the 11th February, on which day I hope that sentence can be passed in your case. I'm adjourning your case for the purpose solely of seeing whether or not there is a mental health package which can be formulated and placed before me. But I must make it clear to you that the fact that I'm giving that opportunity to you and your lawyers does not mean that I'm necessarily going to follow it." Chapter 15. The Diagnosis. At the psychological evaluation, Edwin stared at the stack of forms before him. One of them asked him to rank between 1, definitely agree, and 4, definitely disagree, his reaction to a long list of statements, including, "I prefer to do things the same way over and over again. I live life for today rather than the future. I find making up stories easy. I don't like to take risks. When I talk on the phone, I'm not sure when it's my turn to speak. How on earth was he supposed to respond to, "I would never break a law, no matter how minor"? 3. Mildly disagree? The man observing him had lean features, thinning hair, and a posh London accent. He peered at Edwin through wire-framed lenses, studying his mannerisms.
"Sorry, am I making you uncomfortable?" he asked.
Yeah, Edwin replied. The man was Dr. Simon Baron Cohen, director of the Autism Research Center at Cambridge University, and Britain's leading authority on autism and Asperger's syndrome. He also happens to be a cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen, the comedian behind the famed Borat character. Baron Cohen is occasionally approached by legal defense teams to conduct psychiatric evaluations of their clients and draft expert reports. His diagnosis of Gary McKinnon, a Scot who hacked into the Pentagon in 2001, gave the British government a basis to decline the U.S. extradition request on the grounds that American prisons were ill-equipped to care for him. It was the McKinnon affair that gave rise to the term Asperger's defense. Because of the way Edwin had spoken about the theft, that he didn't see taking the birds from the museum as such a big deal, and that he never thought he'd get caught, his attorneys thought his actions might be explained by some form of autism. Now Baron Cohen was charged with determining whether Edwin suffered from the disorder. After Edwin filled out the questionnaire, he talked to Baron Cohen about fly tying, his childhood, his goals for the future, and all the terrible things that were being said about him in the forums. In his 4-page report, which was presented to the court on University of Cambridge letterhead, Baron Cohen spoke admiringly about Edwin's hobby, noting that he'd taken fly tying to the highest level of an art form and is deeply immersed in the subject both as an artist and from a historical perspective. The report included a photo of one of Edwin's flies, known as the Green Highlander. "He explained to me how each feather is different," Baron Cohen wrote, "and how his deep interest is in understanding the nature of each feather. Following a century-old pattern, the fly called for feathers from the ostrich, summer duck, swan, bustard, peacock, golden pheasant, mallard, jungle cock, blue and yellow macaw, and above all, Indian crow." The doctor was apparently unaware that some of these birds were protected by domestic and international conservation laws. "He had not been motivated by money," Baron Cohen stressed to the court. Edwin had told the professor about the glory days of Kelsen and the Victorians, back when longshoremen unloaded ships full of exotic bird skins at the nearby port of London. He said he'd taken the birds only to help bring about the second such golden age, and that he dreamed of producing a book on fly tying with photos of the stolen birds. According to Baron Cohen, it wasn't greed that drove Edwin, but an obsessional interest in fly tying that made him so over-focused on this art form and all of its intricate detail that he developed a classic form of tunnel vision, in only being able to think about the materials and the products he aspired to make, and not about the social consequences for himself or others. When viewed in this light, breaking into the museum had seemed entirely logical, Baron Cohen wrote. He had felt the only bad thing he had done was breaking the window. It had not dawned on him that he had done anything bad in taking the stuffed birds, and he certainly never wished to upset the specialist fly-tying community in which he was one of the most highly respected artists internationally. Baron Cohen reported that Edwin now understands he upset them by breaking their trust, but at the time, this had not even been on his radar. To the psychopathologist, the fact that Edwin hadn't anticipated that his fellow fly-tiers might be angry with him and even publicly condemn him for implicating them in his crime was consistent with Asperger's. After detailing the principal challenges faced by people with the syndrome, struggling to make friends or read cues in social situations, the professor wrote that Asperger's also prevents the individual from conforming to social norms and leads the individual vulnerable to getting into trouble with the law through social naivete or poor decision-making. "All of these issues apply to Edwin," he informed the court, adding that the student's scores on the diagnostic forms are very much in line with this diagnosis, and he shows all the signs of the condition, a pattern of over-focus on small details. which can also be the basis of his talents in fly tying, music, and photography, for example, alongside difficulties and social understanding. In conclusion, Baron Cohen wrote, I am persuaded that the shock of being arrested, the shock of how his reputation as a very serious artist and a world leader in the fly-tying community has been badly affected, and the feedback from that community and from the police and negative media coverage of the crime have all led to him learning a sobering lesson, such that the risk of him committing a similar crime in the future is negligible. He recommended that, rather than imprisonment, Edwin be given resources and counseling. He also felt it would be best for Edwin to continue his hobby. Therapeutically, he wrote, I have encouraged him not to drop out of the fly-tying world or to drop his long-standing desire to write an important and scholarly book, but instead to complete this writing project and also include an autobiographical chapter in it to explain how his undiagnosed Asperger's led him to commit a crime which he now regrets. In the initial hearing, Judge Gulick had made clear that an exploration of Edwin's mental health was no guarantee of a light sentence. But now that they were armed with a diagnosis of Asperger's from such a prominent authority, Edwin's attorneys began looking for ways to tie the judge's hands. Chapter 16. The Asperger's Defense. All rose as Judge Gulick entered the chamber. It was April 8, 2011. Coincidentally, that day also marked the end of spring term at the Royal Academy of Music. Depending on how the judge ruled, Edwin could either march across the graduation stage in a few months' time or shuffle out in chains that very afternoon. The maximum sentence for his crimes would put the 22-year-old behind bars until his early 30s. David Crimes, the prosecutor for the Crown, knew of the Asperger's diagnosis, but nonetheless felt confident in his argument. To him, Edwin seemed fully aware of the consequences of his actions and should be sentenced in accordance with the law, without special consideration of Baron Cohen's report. Contrary to Baron Cohen's contention that Edwin had committed the crime for art, Crimes stressed that the offense was committed for financial gain, and that it was not impulsive, but carefully planned. He introduced 27 pieces of hard evidence, covering everything from the logistics of the burglary to what was found on Edwin's computer and in his apartment. He ticked through the facts that Adele had uncovered. On November 5, 2008, 7 months before the burglary, Edwin had visited the museum under false pretenses, posing as a photographer to help out another researcher. He had photographed far more than bird skins, taking photographs of the area around the museum, paths, windows, and fences included, showing the defendant at that particular stage was planning his means of entry and, indeed, exit from the museum. They had found a document on his computer, dated July 4, 2008, entitled Plan for Museum Invasion. The prosecution directed the judge's attention to notes from Adele's interrogation, during which Edwin had explained that he used the money to buy a new flute, that he had student debt, and that his parents in America also had financial problems, arguing that even in his interview, the defendant was accepting that there was a significant financial element to his crime. Crimes then referred the judge to an August 30, 2008 online chat between Edwin and his roommate, in which the defendant talked about, and I quote, a scheme for raising money by stealing birds from the British Museum of Natural History. This kind of prosecution didn't require courtroom antics, just a steady accumulation of damning information. Crimes must have suspected that the quirkiness of the case, a flautist stealing birds from an old museum to sell to men obsessed with an obsolete Victorian art form, might lead the court to overlook its gravity. So he read from a report submitted by Dr. Richard Lane, the museum's director of science, who described it as a catastrophic event, not only a loss to the UK, but to the knowledge and heritage of the planet. Dr. Lane's report spoke of the degradation of the skins that were returned, the tags that had been snipped off, and the skins that were still at large. He explained that researchers couldn't go into a jungle to gather new specimens to replace a 200-year-old skin. Their scientific value was derived in large part from their age. They were archival relics of a lost era. In taking them, Edwin had been stealing knowledge from humanity. Lane, who had worked at the Natural History Museum for over 42 years, had sat through hours of proceedings over the previous several months, waiting for the gears of justice to turn, only to see the sentencing hearing delayed and delayed. Now that it was finally time, he was optimistic, despite the prosecution's warning that in the courtroom, things didn't always go as you might expect them by natural justice. Sitting in the defendant's box, Edwin tried to hold on to a shred of dignity. After all, he and his father had tried to recover some of the birds by messaging a number of his customers, but there was no mention of this. As crimes continued and the evidence against him mounted, Edwin felt his most basic sense of self under assault. The prosecution was making him out to be some kind of demon. "There's one TIC to be put to the defendant," said Crimes, referring to an additional piece of information that the Crown wished to be taken into consideration in the sentencing. Edwin had stolen a TV from a Royal Academy of Music common room. Upon Edwin's admission, the judge agreed to take it into account, and the prosecution rested. Judge Gullick, who ran an efficient courtroom, turned to Edwin's barrister.
"Now, Mr. Dawson, I have read an abundance of paper."
Dawson had submitted a sheaf of documents for the judge's consideration. Since his client had already admitted his guilt, the barrister's aim was to mitigate the severity of the punishment. In addition to Baron Cohen's diagnosis, he had pulled together character references in support of the young flautist from David Dickey, Edwin's childhood tutor at the American Museum of Natural History, Ed Muzzerall, his first instructor in Victorian salmon flies, John McLean, the proprietor of FeathersMC.com, who had first taught Edwin the ropes of sourcing rare feathers, and Luke Couturier, who had encouraged Edwin to visit the Tring Museum in the first place. But the judge didn't seem particularly interested in these references. He wanted to talk about the precedents from British case law that the defense had flagged for his attention as a guide for determining a fair sentence. And while the prosecution had introduced a damning pile of evidence that the act was premeditated and motivated by financial gain, it took all of 90 seconds and one precedent for the defense to wrest control of the hearing. All it had to do was mention the case of Crown versus Gibson.
"Before we go any further," said the judge, "as far as you're aware, the case of Gibson presumably is the only that's come up on the system with Asperger's on it."
"It is," replied Dawson.
"Well, it doesn't seem to me that this case is any different from that case," the judge stated.
"It's not," Dawson echoed. "I can speak at some length, Your Honor."
"I'm sure you can.
If Your Honor wants me to, or if Your Honor..."
"Well," the judge interrupted, "put it this way. If I were to take a view which possibly, I don't know which newspapers are here, but if certain newspapers took the view that this young man should be locked up forever, I think the Court of Appeal might take a different view."
"Yes, I absolutely agree, Your Honor," Dawson replied, surely beaming with the knowledge that he'd won before even stepping into the court that day.
"Gibson," remarked Gullick, "is in one sense even more shocking on its facts as to what the individual did."
A decade earlier, in December 2000, 21-year-old Simon Gibson and two of his friends crept into Arnos Vale Cemetery in the heart of Bristol, established in the early 19th century just off the southern banks of the River Avon. Near its entrance looms an arched memorial erected in 1921 for the 500 servicemen killed during World War I. "The Glorious Dead, A.D. 1914 to 1918, is carved deeply into its bath stone. Gibson and his friends crept past the monument before stopping in front of a large crypt. The door was secured with a padlock, which Gibson broke off with a hammer. Inside were 34 coffins dating from the 1800s. Before each hung a headplate bearing the name of the deceased. They had meant only to look around, but when they noticed a damaged tomb, they cleared away the stones, pried open the coffin, and stole a skull and some vertebrae. On their way out, they locked the crypt with a replacement padlock that Gibson had purchased for the occasion. Back at their apartment, they washed the skull in bleach, hosed it off in the garden, and fashioned a necklace out of the vertebrae. When they went back a second time, they brought a crowbar. After opening another coffin and discovering that the body had not decomposed fully, they left it alone. But on their way out, they stole a memorial flower vase. They made a party of their third visit, bringing booze, candles, and a camera. As they drank, they posed with the dead, snapping photos inside the crypt. In one, Gibson held up a skull like Hamlet's poor Yorick. When they brought the film to be developed at Broadmead, a shopping mall in Bristol, they accidentally dropped a few of the photos on their way out. When a security guard discovered them, the police were notified. When they descended upon Gibson's home, they found the human remains and the vase, which was resting in the middle of the dining table. The Crown Court judge sentenced Gibson, the ringleader, to 18 months, declaring his actions offensive to the public and disrespectful of the deceased. His friends received lighter sentences. Edwin's attorneys were drawn to the case not by what happened during the trial, but what had transpired during Gibson's appeal. Gibson, as it turns out, had been diagnosed with Asperger's. The Court of Appeal judge, who described Gibson's obsession with skeletons as nearly uncontrollable, that seeing the open coffins was akin to a chocoholic being let loose in a Cadbury's factory, believed the Crown Court judge had erred by not taking the diagnosis into account when determining the young man's sentence. Gibson and his friends were released 2 days later. Judge Gullick adjourned to his chambers to decide on a sentence. When he swept back into the courtroom at 4:05 p.m., Edwin shot to his feet. "Edwin Rist, you may sit," he began. "You're 22 years old. You've no criminal convictions. You are a gifted and highly intelligent musician who's currently studying at the Royal College of Music. You were in your teens a gifted and internationally known fly tyer. In November 2008, you fraudulently obtained permission to photograph items at the National History Museum in Tring. Using your knowledge of what was there, you broke into a block at that museum on the night of 23rd to 24th June 2009 and stole 299 bird skins. They were taken, I have no doubt, for financial gain, but principally to enable you to use the feathers for fly tying. The loss of their birds is a natural history disaster of world proportions. These were in effect priceless specimens, both in terms of their financial value, but also in terms of their scientific interest. They are literally, in many cases, irreplaceable." The judge then referenced Baron Cohen's report, which stated that Edwin was suffering at the material time from Asperger's syndrome, and it is that condition which is behind this behavior. "The public may consider that such a serious offense as this would quite properly merit a lengthy prison sentence," Gullick continued. "However, I have been directed to a case called Gibson in the Court of Appeal almost 10 years ago, which has much in it to assist me to evaluate how the diagnosis of Asperger's should be dealt with by the courts." The judge then read out 5 paragraphs from the Gibson ruling, verbatim. "I have read extensively from that case to assist not only you but members of the public and to assist those who may read the newspapers to understand why it is that I am taking the course of action which I do. Mr. Gibson's case," he went on, "in terms of his obsessional behavior, is in one sense no different from yours." As he neared his ruling, Gullick explained the bind Gibson had put him in. "Were I to pass a substantial prison sentence upon you, which would be wholly merited by the value, if not pricelessness, of the items that you stole, no doubt on one view the public would commend me, and on another view the Court of Appeal, in my judgment, would severely criticize me in the light of the attitude which they display in the case of Gibson as to the appropriate course that trial judges should take when faced with somebody suffering from this syndrome." He turned to Edwin.
All that can be done is to try to support you and attempt to ensure that this sort of behavior is not repeated. Then the sentence came down. 12 months suspended. So long as he didn't commit any new crimes during that period, Edwin would never spend a night behind bars. Chapter 17. The Missing Skins. The fly tyer's reactions to Edwin's sentencing ranged from outrage to bewilderment to conspicuous silence. Asperger's as a defense? Fuck right off, mate. This was well planned, one wrote. An Australian tyer was shocked by the way Edwin had skittered through the courts. If I gain the trust of the curator, rob the museum and sell the goods afterwards, I'm going to do a bit of shovel, slang for spending time in prison. Even if he was kept out of prison, he should have suffered a serious fine and deportation. Terry chimed in with skepticism about the Asperger's diagnosis. When the young tyer had given a demonstration at his Bristol Fly Dressers Guild, he wrote, "He certainly did not display any of the symptoms one would associate with it." By comparison, the reaction from Edwin's conservatory was muted. In the hierarchy of misbehavior that might trigger expulsion from an elite institution like the Royal Academy of Music, a felony theft of scientifically invaluable bird skins didn't rate. Not only was Edwin going to graduate, he'd be flying to Germany on June 7th to audition for an orchestra. He couldn't believe his luck. On June 30th, he received his diploma along with the rest of his class. The only thing still hanging over his head was the Proceeds of Crime Act confiscation order, the final step in the sentencing process that would determine the size of his fine. The appointed day was July 29th. The proceedings were brief. The prosecution's rough math, based on an estimate by a London auctioneer, put the value of the stolen skins at £250,300. It would only later become evident just how conservative this valuation was. To calculate Edwin's fine, they decided to halve that amount. This led to a confiscation order in the amount of £125,150, or $204,753. According to Crimes, Edwin had £13,371 available to pay in his bank account at that moment, but suggested a deadline of 6 months for payment, arguing that the Crown wouldn't want the defendant to lose his piccolo and flute. The judge agreed. Should he come into more money at a later date, Detective Sergeant Joe Quinlivan of the Hertfordshire Constabulary's Economic Crime Unit told reporters, police will be seeking this from him up to the total outstanding figure. This is a very positive result for us and sends a strong message that making money through crime never pays, he added. Though Edwin had volunteered a number of his customers' names during the interrogation, as far as the police were concerned, the case was closed. They didn't have the resources to troll through forums and eBay and PayPal records in hope of recovering more of the skins, which would likely have been separated from their tags and therefore worthless to the Tring. But the fallout continued to reverberate through the fly-tying community. Several of Edwin's customers, including Mortimer, the American dentist, and Dave Carn, sent birds in varying degrees of degradation back to the museum. A number who had done so were now planning to bring personal lawsuits against Edwin, seeking restitution. Jens Pilgaard, the Danish blacksmith, returned a number of birds that he'd bought from Edwin. He had already sold the flame bowerbird to another fly tyer, but when he discovered it was part of the Tring heist, he insisted on buying it back so that it could be sent to the museum. He asked Adele if the $4,500 Malayan peacock pheasant he'd traded Edwin might be returned to him, CCing Edwin's father, Curtis, on his email. Curtis had reached out to a number of the angriest buyers, seeking to make right by them. If you can give me a full accounting in dollars, I will send this off to you, he wrote to Jens, at the same time making clear that he would not do so if Jens was planning to sue his son. You cannot have it both ways. I am sure you understand. He now found himself warding off potential fraud claims against Edwin. Jens returned the skins but was never compensated by Curtis.
Dave Karn, who had borrowed thousands of dollars from his mother in order to purchase an Indian Crow cape, first found out about Edwin's arrest when Curtis emailed him, out of the blue, to see if he knew anyone who'd bought full skins from his son. Karn nearly cried at the disappointment of thinking he would lose a skin he'd been trying to get hold of for 5 years. He recalls Curtis saying that if he didn't return his patch to the Tring, he might get raided by the police. A terrifying prospect. Having a load of local bobbies piling into the house would of course have been disastrous, since they, in ignorance, would have just collected every feather in my tying, and then I'd have had to spend months proving they hadn't come from Edwin, and would probably still not have had them back now. Karn was angry. When he returned the Indian Crow cape to the museum, he was informed by authorities that he could make a claim against Edwin for extracting money under false pretenses. Months after being persuaded by Curtis not to press suit, Karn finally received compensation. The spring 2011 issue of Fly Tire magazine, which had previously heralded Edwin as the future of fly tying, featured a new section called The Fly Tying Crime Report. In a brief account of the burglary, Dick Talour, a longtime columnist for the magazine, told the reporter about the time he'd seen two men arrested at a fly tying show in Massachusetts. "We haven't had any problems with the legal people in some time. I'm now afraid that good people who are trying to do it properly are going to be under the gun." But at ClassicFlyTying.com, Bud Guidry assiduously enforced his policy of no discussion of the Tring incident. If a newcomer made the mistake of referencing the name Edwin Rist or the Tring heist, he promptly deleted it. Before long, the community returned to normal. Within a few months, members began to post Indian Crow and Blue Chatterer feathers again. Birds of paradise and resplendent Quetzal feathers made regular yet brief appearances on eBay, suggesting they were being scooped up quickly. Whether any of these feathers had been plucked from the Tring's missing skins was unclear, but the community's hunger for feathers only continued to grow. Back in Tring, Adele had mixed feelings about how the case had turned out. She was proud that she'd arrested the burglar and recovered so many of the skins for the museum in the process, but was frustrated that Edwin wasn't going to serve any time. She kept faith in the system, though, knowing it was the judge's decision to make, and his alone. Crimes, the Crown prosecutor, believed Dr. Baron Cohen's diagnosis of Asperger's had swung the whole case. "Had there not been such a report," he said, "it is likely that Mr. Rist would have received an immediate custodial sentence of some length." At the Natural History Museum, Dr. Press Jones was still reeling from the events of the past year. "The whole thing was a complete kick in the guts," he said. "It was desperately, deeply depressing." Despite its staff members' private dismay, the museum maintained a more neutral public posture. In a press release dated April 8th, the day of Edwin's sentencing, Richard Lane, the museum's head of science, was quoted as saying, "We are pleased the matter has been resolved. We would like to thank the police, media, public, and fly-tying community for their help in recovering many of these priceless specimens, but there has still been a terrible impact on our national collections." There were still a lot of birds missing, though. Of the 299 stolen, only 102 intact birds had been recovered, with their labels attached. 72 more had been seized from Edwin's apartment without any labels, and another 19 skins, all missing their tags, had been mailed to the museum by customers who were either named by Edwin or were compelled by conscience to return them. And while the curators at the Tring had numerous Ziploc bags with individual feathers, 106 birds were still missing. The value of the outstanding Indian Crow, Katinga, King Bird of Paradise, and resplendent Quetzal skins alone easily topped $400,000. And this didn't account for the missing crimson fruit crows, flame bower birds, magnificent rifle birds, superb birds of paradise, and blue birds of paradise, which hit the market so infrequently that determining their true worth was difficult. All this presumes selling the birds in one piece, wholesale. If someone were to pluck the feathers and sell them individually, the value would climb even higher. Had Edwin already sold the 106 skins and hidden his profits somewhere beyond the reach of British authorities? Had he stashed the skins somewhere else? Had he sent them to someone he trusted for safekeeping? But at this point, no one was looking for them, and no one was asking these questions. Except for one guy, wading up a river in New Mexico. Part 3. Truth and Consequences. Chapter 18. The 21st International Fly Tying Symposium. 2 weeks after Spencer Syme told me about the train heist, and only 4 months after Edwin's sentencing, I dialed into a meeting with the National Security Council from a writer's retreat in Taos, New Mexico. A handful of refugee organizations, including the List Project, had been invited to speak to the president's senior advisors. The call didn't go well. I was combative and frustrated, tired of hearing the same official excuses for inaction. As soon as I hung up, I gathered up my fishing gear and sped off toward the snow-dusted Sangre de Cristo Mountains, anticipating the moment my phone lost its signal. I parked my car on the eastern rim of the Rio Grande River Valley and hiked down the Little Arsenic into the gorge. The sound of water breaking over truck-sized boulders echoed against the canyon walls, drowning out my thoughts. After about an hour, I reached the river and assembled my fly rod. My waders clung tightly to my legs in the frigid water, and my breathing slowed as I started to cast. The fly, a tuft of elk hair fashioned into the shape of a moth-like caddis fly, drifted quickly across the surface of the river. As I sloshed along in solitude, searching for trout, I wondered how I would ever put the war behind me. I had spent a year trying to rebuild a country whose citizens didn't want us there, a year recovering from a near-death experience and post-traumatic stress, and the subsequent half-decade struggling against my own government on behalf of refugees that nobody wanted here. I might have been depressed were it not for the strange story of the feather thief. In the short time since I'd heard about the incident, I had become consumed by the crimes of Edwin Rist. It was so bizarre as to be distracting. After Spencer mentioned the classicflytying.com forum, I signed up and searched for Edwin, finding two posts from November 2009, where he said he was selling Indian crow feathers in order to buy a new flute. I printed them out, then copied down the names of everyone who had replied. I found Bud Guidry's post, declaring that all subsequent Tring-related discussions would be removed, and I wondered what else had been deleted. I found customer reviews for Flute Player 1988 on eBay and videos of Edwin on YouTube. I didn't have a strategy. I didn't have any experience tracking thieves. I didn't know anything about birds or salmon flies. In my free time, I clicked away, printing out the conversations of a strange subculture that had spawned this almost unbelievable crime. I kept asking Spencer for help deciphering the jargon in the forum. Whenever we fished, I peppered him with questions about Victorian fly tires and the feathers they used. In an effort to understand the allure of the art form, I spent 6 hours at his home learning to tie the Red Rover, a yellow, orange, and red fly described in Kelson's The Salmon Fly. While his tawny lab, Boomer, dozed at his feet and Towns Van Zandt warbled from an unseen radio, Spencer explained the arcane techniques required to tether plumes to a hook, patiently answering my barrage of questions. I mentioned an article in the British press that suggested the Tring was still missing more than 100 of its birds, allegedly worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and asked if he thought the fly-tying community still had them. "If you really want to find out," he said with a glint in his eye, "get yourself to Somerset." 2 weeks later, after discovering that I had been removed from the National Security Council's invitation list for future meetings, I found myself searching for plane tickets to attend the 21st International Fly Tying Symposium at the Doubletree Hotel in Somerset, New Jersey. I was aware that I was running from my problems, but I had the crazy thought that if I just showed up, I might stumble upon the missing birds of Tring. Outside the Doubletree, semis barreled down Interstate 287 over the Raritan River. In the late November chill, I cut across the parking lot and saw John McClane, immediately recognizable from photos I'd seen on the forum, burn a cigarette down in what seemed like three drags near a hotel side door. The proprietor of FeathersMC.com had a fresh gash running across his forehead and a "don't ask" look on his face. I considered posing some questions about Edwin, but when he shot a steely glance at me, I nervously hurried past.